little boy desperately wanted $100. He figured that's how much he needed to buy all the toys that he thought he had to have. So he prayed to God that he would get that $100. He prayed for a whole week, but nothing happened. So he decided to write a letter to God. He wrote a letter requesting that God would send him that $100. When the post office got the letter addressed to God, they weren't sure what to do with it. So the post office decided that the closest they could do from their standpoint was they just sent it on to Washington. Send it to the president. The president surprisingly received it. Was very impressed, touched, and probably a little amused that the little boy wanted that. So he instructed his aide to send the boy $5. He thought $5 would be a lot to a little boy. The boy indeed was delighted that he got the money. He sat down and immediately wrote a thank you note, which read, "Dear God, thank you very much for sending the money. However, I noticed that for some reason you had to send it through Washington, and as usual, they kept most of it." I want to talk to you tonight about a passage of Scripture that we normally think of from the standpoint of a starting point, really, to build a theology, perhaps, on two kingdoms. How earthly governments are to relate or to be related to God's kingdom. And the things that are owed to earthly governments and the things that are owed to God's kingdom. For most of my life, that's how I've looked at this particular passage. But I want to suggest to you that rather than talking about two kingdoms, that perhaps the emphasis of this passage is supposed to be two images. 2,000 years ago, most people like us did not like paying taxes. They weren't any different than we are. The Jews in particular had a deeper and perhaps a little more meaningful debate in their own heart on the real morality of paying a tax or supporting a government like Rome. Almost all of us know the latter part of a paragraph here in Matthew 22 that talks about render under Caesar the things that are Caesar's and unto God the things that are God's. Yet perhaps the familiarity with this passage has made us miss what may be the deeper meaning that I think may be intended here. I appreciate your being here tonight. I am grateful for the songs that we were able to participate in one with another and enjoyed Rick's leading it for us tonight. I can empathize with him, having raised three teenagers myself. I can empathize having been a teenager. That was probably worse than any of the three that I tried to raise. But I would add one thing to what he had to say. I thought when my third child came along, she was a little later than the other two. We really hadn't planned, so there's a pretty good age spread between the second and third child. And she came along, and I was a little later in life, and my patience was much greater by that time, and She really was just easier to raise than my two boys were. And I don't think that has anything to do with the boys. I think that has everything to do with me. And I began to think, you know, I'm finally getting a handle on this. Then my oldest son, with his little four-year-old red-headed boy, moved close enough to us that I could be with him pretty regularly. And I want to tell you, four-year-old grandchildren with 60-year-old grandparents, I haven't gotten near the patience that I thought I had. We all need to do some introspection at times, and even when we get confident, perhaps, in what we've become or what we've overcome, we need to step back and look just a little bit. That's what I want us to try to do for just a minute tonight. I hope we do it well. Look in Matthew 22 with me. We're going to use that as a text. And we're going to begin by looking in verses 15 and 16. Then the Pharisees went and plotted how they might entangle him in his talk. And they sent to him their disciples with the Herodians, saying, "Teacher, we know that you are true and teach the way of God in truth. Nor do you care about anyone, for you do not regard the person of men." Here's a confrontation that takes place in the life of our Lord. It certainly is not the first one, and it will not be the only one that he has to deal with. We're told of several, and by what John tells us at the end of his letter, there must have been multitudes that aren't even written about. The books aren't enough to hold everything that really would be indicative of what happened to him. But here's a confrontation, this time with some rather strange bedfellows, the Pharisees and the Herodians. You're talking about opposite ends here of thought. The Pharisees were the ultra-conservative of their day and time. They were the ones who Jesus perhaps was most critical of at times because they would bind so many things on others and yet were unable to keep even themselves all the things that they would bind on someone else. But understand and appreciate, these were the most conservative thinking people of their day and time. I suspect that if we had lived back during that time, we would relate with them better than any other group of the Jews. These were the conservatives. The opposite of that is these Herodians. They were the ultra-liberal thinkers. They were the ultra-liberal in their actions. They were the far left. They were staunch supporters of Herod, whose power came from Rome. So they were in favor of Roman rule and a Roman king, Herod, at that time. The very opposite, if you would, of the Pharisees. And yet here are these Pharisees and these Herodians getting together. Remember the old parable or the old phrase? The enemy of my enemies is my friend. I think that's exactly what happens here. Normally they would have been at odds with each other. But the Pharisees and the Herodians could agree that they were all against Jesus. So they gang up, if you would. They gather together on this occasion because they have a common enemy that they see, and that is the Lord. And they lay a trap. Look in verse 17. "Tell us, therefore, what do you think? Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? You have these conspirators from opposite sides of the spectrum, so to speak. And these conspirators set up a trap. And the trap is fairly simple. Do we empower Rome? Do we give honor and respect to Rome by paying taxes? Now, taxes were something that the Jews were very familiar with. From what I can read, as much as I think personally that we're all overtaxed, so don't go out of here thinking that, you know, I'm comfortable with taxes. But we're not in as bad a shape as the Jews were. The Jews paid a 10% tax that was called the ground tax. And it was tax on everything that came out of the ground. And we probably can't appreciate that as much as we should because we live in a society now where very few of us farm. We still have farmers, and I'm sure some of you are. And maybe you have a garden in your backyard. But by and large, most of us go to a store and we buy the product because in this day and time, almost everybody farmed. I experience that when I go to Ethiopia. I've told you about being there and won't get off into that. But everyone in Ethiopia has a little piece of ground and grows much of what they're going to live on during the year. Or if they don't live on it themselves, use it to barter for other things that they need to live on. I think it's referred to as an agrarian society. And that was very much the common occasion during this time. A 10% tax on everything that came out of the ground owed to Rome. A 1% tax, the income tax. Wouldn't we all love to just have to pay 1% on our income? A 1% tax on everything that was gained by you in the form of cash. And then what they referred to as the poll tax. A ground tax, an income tax, and a poll tax. A poll tax was a flat fee or a flat tax of 1 denarius every year on men from 14 to 65 and on women from 12 to 65. I have no idea why women had to start paying earlier. If you have an answer for that, I would really be interested or be intrigued by it. I've never been able to find out why they had to start 2 years early, but that's the way it was. For the bulk of your life, you are expected to pay the poll tax every year. And it was not only charged as 1 denarius, but it could only be paid with Roman coin of a denarius. Now, this tax was the most offensive to the Jews, particularly to the Pharisees, because they saw it as a direct violation of at least 2 of the 10 commandments. You see, the denarius was the Roman coin that had the image of Caesar on the coin. And Caesar saw himself as a god and represented himself as a god. So to use this coin to pay the tax, which was required by law to the Pharisee in particular, violated at least 2 of the commandments. One was no other god. Because here was this image of Caesar who saw himself as god. And the other was the graven image. Caesar engraving himself there on that coin. It is this particular tax that I think is under consideration here when they talk about this trap that is laid. And basically, the trap's fairly simple. If Jesus says yes, pay the tax, then the majority of the people, the multitudes, would be against him. The Pharisees were the largest group religiously at that time. And they represented the bulk of the people, particularly the poorer people. And they were the largest in number by far. And all of them felt oppressed by Rome. So to say, we owe this tax to Rome, you need to pay it, would have put a barrier between him and the majority of the Jews. If he says no, don't pay it, then the Herodians, who the Pharisees have teamed up with, are going to charge him with sedition against the government. And they're going to get Herod and his government after him because he's rebelling against Rome. And he's saying, don't pay the Roman tax. You see the trap. Yes or no, they've foreseen that it's going to be something that is difficult and harmful to Jesus as a teacher. But his response, as was commonly the case, really avoids and puts the enemy to flight, so to speak. Jesus' response begins with a comment on their motives. Look in verse 18. Jesus saw their wickedness. And he said, "Why do you test me, you hypocrites?" He begins by bringing their motives to light. And I think hypocrites here in particular is aimed at the Pharisees. Because the Pharisees paid the poll tax. They weren't going to get in conflict with the Roman government. They weren't going to have the soldiers knocking on their door. They weren't going to have an invasion. They paid the poll tax, even though it violated their conscience to do so. They weren't willing to stand up for what they believed in, what they felt was right. And that is, you shouldn't be involved with that denarius, and you shouldn't be giving honor to Caesar as God and paying with his coin. Jesus looks, I think, in particular at the Pharisees here and says, "You hypocrites." It may be simply just a reference back to the statement earlier here when they said, "We know that you are true and you teach the way of God in truth." He may just be looking back and saying, "Well, you're saying the things that sound good on the outside, but you just don't mean them. They really aren't what in your heart." Either way, he sees the wicked intent of the trap that they've laid. And he talks about their motive. It's hypocritical. Then he provides the answer, or the out, if you would. "Show me the tax money." They bring him the denarius. Verse 20, he said to them, "Whose image and inscription is this?" And they said to him, "Caesar's." And he said to them the things that we know so well. "Render therefore to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." And when they had heard these words, they marveled and left him and went on their way. The Greek word here that is translated render or give, depending on the version that you may be looking at, is a Greek word that literally means to give back or to return. And what Jesus literally says here is, you give back to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. And you give back to God the things that are God's. If it's been given by Rome,
then give it to Rome. Return it to Rome.
It's interesting to me that Jesus could have stopped here, because this answers both the Pharisees and the Herodians at this time. The Herodians, he said, pay the tax. If it belongs to Rome, give it to Rome. So there's no sedition. There's no charge that can be brought against him with the government. With the Pharisees, he says, pay with a clear conscience. The denarius was not theirs anyway. It was Caesar's. And you're simply giving back to Caesar what was his. Now, with all that tonight as introduction, I want to teach you the lesson. And thankfully, the lesson won't take near as long as the introduction did. I learned that from my daddy. And you've probably heard that before from him. I want to talk to you about what I think is the real lesson of this particular occasion with the Lord. I don't argue against the things that belong to the government are due to the government, and the things that belong to the Lord are due to the Lord, and the concept there of doing what is right with the government. I'm not wanting to or willing to argue against that at all. I think that's scriptural and can be justified in other places. But the emphasis here, I believe, is not on kingdoms, but on images. And the lesson seems to me to be a lesson about commitment. Let me give you an example, personal example, of how painful it can be not to be committed. When I first moved to Tennessee, I'd been in school in Kentucky, had met my wife there, we got married. Within a short time, she wanted to move back next to Mama and be close to home, and we moved back to the same area that her mother lived, right outside of Memphis, Tennessee. Shortly after moving there, I got a call from a congregation up in Dyersburg that needed a preacher for a while they looked for someone else. That was 36 years ago, and I'm still filling in. I don't think I'm that good. I just think they're slow learners. Or at least they're slow searchers. But for the first 10 years or so, while both of my boys were still very young and small, we would load up everybody on Sunday morning in the car and drive an hour and 15 minutes up to Dyersburg and spend the day. Go home with somebody there in the congregation, come back in the evening and have service again, and then drive back home. Do the same thing on Wednesday night. We did that for a little over 10 years. It wasn't long that I began to notice a pattern. Every Sunday morning, after we finally rushed and got everything into the car and started that hour and 15-minute drive up to Dyersburg, my wife, sitting in the seat next to me in our little Honda, would look across and begin to critique whether I was dressed and looked good enough to get up in front of everybody that morning. Until that time, she hadn't really paid any attention to me. It was all about getting the baby in the car and all the things the baby was going to need. And a pattern began to develop very quickly. She was terribly concerned with my nose hairs. It took me a while to figure out why, but somehow the light coming through, me sitting there and her looking, she's short, her looking up at me as that light came through, I guess that's what stood out so much to her. And she watched me painfully try to deal with whatever her objections were for a few weeks. All of a sudden, I came home one time during the middle of the week, and there was a little gadget laying there on my dresser. I got that for you.
And now this is back before all the electric and all those other kind of things were popular. It looked like a pair of nail clippers. But instead of the sharp things on the end, it had a little cylinder. I got to looking at it a little closer. It was two cylinders, one inside the other. And they were just the right shape to stick up your nose and then plunge down on that little lever that nail clippers have there. And those cylinders were supposed to rotate and take care of whatever your problem was up there. And she was so proud that I wouldn't have to go through all that other stuff every Sunday morning. And nothing would do, but I had to go right in the bathroom right then and try out her new gadget that she'd gotten for me. I have to tell you, I was not real committed to the idea. And I probably didn't do it real justice. But I went in, put it where it was supposed to be put, and chowed down on that lever. And it wrapped every hair in my nose all up in both of those cylinders and didn't cut a single one off. And I think I cried harder right then than I ever have in my life. And that was just the beginning of the problem. Now they're all wrapped up. That thing's in your nose. I'm scared to death to let go of it, because when you let go of it, it goes back the other way. So after about 5 minutes of great moral courage or bolstering or whatever, I just yanked that thing out of my nose and threw it as far as I could in that small bathroom. It can be painful not to be committed to something. And I learned that lesson the hard way. It's a lesson of commitment that I think that Jesus is trying to teach here. It's the real lesson, I think. Look at the latter part of the 21st verse here. Render therefore to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. You give to Caesar what bears his image. Oh, now hang on. That language ought to key something a little bit for you. Go back to the book of Genesis. Look in the very first chapter of Genesis. Start with me in verse 26. If that coin bore the image of Caesar, what bears the image of God? Genesis 1 and verse 26, then God said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, over the cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God created man in His own image. In the image of God, He created him. Male and female, He created them. The coin bore Caesar's image. But the emphasis I think Jesus is really trying to make here is, where is God's image born? Where is it supposed to be? We owe God the same thing that those citizens owed Caesar. Our whole being. The Pharisees wouldn't have missed this. They would have understood immediately what he was talking about. Jesus had been hammering on them for days, perhaps even weeks. Remember those parables where he was pointing out their failures? God's workers in the vineyard. That's who you are, or supposed to be. But you don't produce the fruit that the owner of the vineyard should rightfully expect. You're God's sons. As a son, you say to the father, oh yes, I'll go and work in the vineyard today just like you wanted me to. But remember the parable? But then the son doesn't go. Said the right things, but he didn't do the work. Or that parable about the sons of the kingdom. And yet when the son has his marriage feast, well, I can't go because of this, and I can't go because of that, or I just don't want to go. They don't show up. Jesus had been hammering those Pharisees for weeks over the fact that you claim to be a child or a disciple in God's kingdom, but you fail in your efforts to serve Him or to give Him what is His rightful due. So here's the real spiritual application, I think, of what this occasion is really supposed to teach. We are God's coins. It's not about how governments and gods are supposed to interact and relate, but it's about us as citizens in God's kingdom. One kingdom. We're supposed to be those ambassadors of Christ to the world about us. We're supposed to be in the world, but not of it. Certain things belong to the world, certain things belong to the government, but we don't belong to anybody but to God. And they'd lost sight of that. I think that's the point, really, of this occasion that Matthew records for us. Not two kingdoms, but two images. And if you can rightly understand that the denarius bearing the image of Caesar belongs back to that government in some form or fashion, that our dollar bill bearing the image of George Washington belongs back to... He's still on the dollar, isn't he? They change it so fast and so often I lose track. He was when I was growing up. If we can understand that principle, how can we fail to understand who we belong to? It's not two kingdoms, but it's two images. How? You give to God what is God's. Look over in verse 37 of this same chapter, Matthew 22. You could quote it probably just as easily as perhaps I can. I won't try. Jesus said to the man, "You shall love the Lord your God." With what? You know, it's interesting to me. He's just gotten through saying, "You're made in His image. Who do you belong to? What do you give back?" You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the first. This is the great commandment. And the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments, in our language, I think he would say, rest everything. Rest all your obligations. In the Jewish language, what he says, on these two commandments rest the law and the prophets. Here's your spiritual duty. Are you committed to it? I'm going to suggest to you, anything less than wholly committed can be painful, is dangerous, can ensnare and trap us.
I won't re-preach to you. You've heard these sermons before. You understand. Who saw themselves as the religious of that day? The most committed. Wasn't it the Pharisees? They were the conservatives. And yet Jesus teaches them about what real commitment is. Are you being conformed into the image of God? You do it with giving your all. You do it with what Paul talks about in Romans 1. By being conformed to His image. And I suggest that's the duty of every one of us. I probably don't say this enough when I get out of the way and visit. I say it pretty often at home. I tell the people where I regularly preach that I very rarely talk to them. And I try not to. I talk to Scott. But what the Bible says that I think Scott needs to hear. And what I tell them is, if it rubs off, good. But this is what I need to hear. Because it's easy for me to get caught up so many other things in this life. And it's easy for my time to get consumed with so many other things that I am able to and want to get involved in. And you look back. What have you done all week? What have you done all month? How much of your life does God really get other than maybe showing up in a service like this? How much service? How much activity? With your whole heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. And He won't settle for anything less. May God help us to recognize whose image we're made in and give us the drive to work to be conformed to that, transformed from the things of this world into the image of His Son and our Savior. If you're not a child of His, and you'd be one tonight, won't you come while we stand and sing?